I'm Jason, and I am the host of the Cuddly Caveman Hour. So we're going to do something a little different than the previous episodes that we've done. And I had this thought of turning this podcast into a more of a personal internal project. And I hope eventually we'll bring people in at a later date. And the reason why that is because one night I had this thought pop into my head, and it was pretty negative. The thought was, you aren't articulate, nothing you say has of any value, and you should just quit podcasting. And some nights went by, and I talked to my wife about it, and she was very encouraging. I'm very thankful to my wife. And then I thought, well, maybe there's something to that negativity. Maybe there's some kernel of truth. And so I thought, I asked the question, how do I articulate myself, and how do I develop my ideas? And I thought, well, maybe if I go back in time to not the very first cavemen, but the descendants of cavemen, starting off with the Stoics. Maybe if I study their philosophies and write about their philosophies, interact with their writings, maybe then I can start really hammering out these free-floating thoughts that I have. I'm just kind of floating around in my head into something more tangible, to where if somebody asks my opinion on something, then I can answer in a more coherent way. So I had that thought, and then I looked over at my mantelpiece. I've got a bunch of books. I've read some, but I've largely ignored a lot of others. And one of them was Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor, and it's kind of the spiritual successor to Epictetus, another Stoic philosopher. And I guess Marcus Aurelius is considered to be one of the pillars of Stoic philosophy. So, and when you think of Stoicism, I think there's the misconception that the Stoics were just these brutish kind of men that didn't talk or didn't show their emotions. Part of that's true, but it goes deeper than that. And I just wanted to share with you guys my thoughts on his writings. So the topic for today is self-restraint, which I consider to be one of the main principles of Stoic philosophy. And the first quote that I came across, this is from book one. He was talking about one of his teachers, Dionetus. Sorry if I butchered that name. Dionetus, this is what he had to say: not to waste time on nonsense, not to be taken in by conjurers and hoodoo artists with their talk about incantations and exorcism. It's on page 5. I'll post a link also in the show notes, so that if you're interested, you can pick up a copy. I got this one off of Amazon. So the thought that I had was that gullibility leads down a path of suffering. And I mean, if you're so gullible to where you trust everything that somebody says, you can get taken advantage of quite a bit. I mean, be it financially, relationships, physical harm, you can put yourself in a lot of danger for being just a little too trusting. And I didn't write this down, but I also had the thought that maybe there's the type of person that remains in that gullible state of mind, so that they can say, they can claim victimhood. Oh, well, this person did this to me, so, you know, I'm the victim. And I think that's part of it, too. You know, you don't want to take responsibility for your own actions, so you put it on other people. So, taking advantage of. And, I mean, at a certain point, as you progress through life, I mean, children are pretty trusting. They're pretty gullible. But something happens between, I don't know, childhood and adulthood, I guess the teenage years, where you start finding out, oh, well, people aren't all that they say that they are. So maybe some kind of discernment needs to happen. And I think, you know, I see myself, I have kids, and I see myself as a father in the future trying to pass these lessons off to my kids. And, you know, I can sit there and talk to them until they're blue in the face, giving them this knowledge. But it's only when they experience those bad situations, does perhaps, hopefully, a light goes off in their head. They think, oh, that's what my dad was talking about. And then that's how you gain true wisdom. So that, oh, well, this situation seems pretty familiar. Seems like what I went through the last time. So I probably just won't engage with this person. And so that lessons, the knowledge that you gain from your elders or your parents, combined with the experience, grants you the wisdom to kind of carry on in your life and kind of hopefully shields you against people that want to do you harm. And I don't know, that was talking to my wife about this very thing, and this thought just popped into my head, and I had to write it down because I thought it was, I don't know, I thought it was pretty smart. I drew out a triangle, and on one of the bottom angles of the triangle, I put lessons/knowledge. And then on the other side, the reverse side, I put experience. And then at the very top of the triangle, I wrote wisdom. And I think that's probably what the Eye of Ra on top of, like, if you flip the dollar bill, U.S. dollar bill around, you'll see a triangle with the Eye of Ra on top. I think perhaps that represents wisdom. So, and in my own life, I mean, becoming a father, becoming a husband, you know, how can I lead my family towards success if I can't discern fact from fiction? You know, so I consider myself to be a trusting individual. However, there are moments where I don't know how to describe it. but there's just this instinct that I get from certain people. And I think, maybe not. And that did not take, that was not an overnight thing for me. That was years and years of, you know, dealing with people, dealing, I kind of fell in with these Scientologists, and I didn't know it at the time. I thought, you know, they were pretty smooth-talking individuals, and they kind of would pay me compliments, and it kind of got into this realm of, there was also a bunch of like alien conspiracy, conspiratorial kind of stuff. A lot of stuff that they said that sounded really good, but didn't quite, you know, they didn't have any proof to back up what they said. But anyway, you know, the compliments and the, you're a powerful individual, all that played, they were playing to my ego. That's how they, that's how people like that draw you in. They pay you compliments. They inflate your ego, which is really hard to avoid, I have to admit. And then I think it started coming to a halt when I took my first Scientology course. And the first red flag for me was my friend said that I had to pay to take this course. My friend said, Jason, you got to take this course because, you know, this was, I think this was just before 2012. So it was like a big, you know, all the conspiracies were coming out about 2012. And, you know, you have to align all of your spiritual chakras, to defend yourself, to protect yourself against what's going to come. And I told my friend, look, I don't have $100 on me just laying around. I'm sorry, but, you know, I just can't take the course. And he said, you know what? Fine. I'll pay for you to take this course. Just come in and take it. And geez, I don't remember all of what this guy said, but I remember there was a certain point where the guy was talking about having all of these different souls in your body, and you had to align them all so that your main soul identity body, the body that you're inhabiting now, all your chakras could align. And he was saying, like, I don't know, saying all this fluffy woo-woo stuff. And I was looking around at everybody in this course, just thinking, wow, this is a lot to take in. And, that was hard for me. I mean, I closed my eyes and just kind of playing along, and I just thought, wow, this guy either believes himself or he's insane. And I wouldn't say that that course was all bad. It, you know, it helped me process my anger towards my father and my stepfather in a way that I think was beneficial for me. And so yeah, there is that. So I've dealt with people, and then, well, more to the story, I actually didn't go back to school that fall because I mean, my friends were really on this, you know, December, whatever, 2012. It is coming. You know, there's a lot of fear-based stuff. And so I didn't go back to school at NAU that fall just for that reason. I took some online courses and I stayed here in the White Mountains. And December, whatever, came. 2012, nothing happened. And I was so upset with myself for believing all the things that, you know, my quote-unquote friends had told me. And that taught me the lesson of not being too trusting. It really did. So yeah. Moving on. I also had this thought that perhaps gullibility is a form of lazy thinking, specifically for adults. You know, it takes work on the part of the adult to, you know, be really engaged in the conversation that you're having with the other person that maybe doesn't have your best interest at heart. So, you know, during a conversation, if you're really focused, you're reading social cues from the person, you're paying attention to what they're saying, and you're hopefully paying attention to your gut instinct. And this is what I was kind of talking about before. You know, when I'm talking to an individual, I'm feeling them out. I don't know necessarily how to describe that, but I'm really studying the person. And there's a feeling I get if somebody isn't being totally genuine. There's a vibration, and I don't know how to describe it other than that. There's like a vibration that I feel in the pit of my stomach. And it doesn't feel good. And if I start feeling that, then I don't know. I don't give an exact answer. Kind of try to duck out of the conversation and just simply not engage anymore. Because I've ignored that feeling in the past, and it never came to anything good. So I've learned to pay attention to what my body is telling me during a conversation. I know that probably sounds weird. And then I had this other thought written down. Restrain the childlike trust of youth to properly move forward as a leader. So, and the thought is that you can't be overly suspicious, because then you can't move forward in life and in your relationships. You're always going to think that your significant other or your friends are out to get you. Your quote-unquote friends are out to get you. So there has to be this balance between, you know, having some trust, but also having some level of suspicion as well. And so there's that walking the middle path between trust and suspicion. I think that's about as good as I can get that train of thought. Moving on to the next quote that I felt highlights the self-restraint topic. And this quote has two parts to it, and I took a lot of time to try to break this down as best as I could. This is from another one of Marcus Aurelius's teachers named Sextus. Blah. The quote is, not to display anger or other emotions, to be free of passion and yet full of love. That's what Marcus Aurelius thought about his teacher, Sextus. And the first part of it, not to display anger or other emotions, I just wrote down emotion mind. An emotion mind is the state of mind where your emotions just override logical thought. I work for a behavioral health organization, and we've been steeped in dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, and they kind of break it down into three different minds. So emotion mind is one aspect of the human psyche. Then there's I guess the best that I could explain it is logical mind or the thinking mind. And then once you combine the logical or thinking mind with the emotion mind, then you get to the wise mind, when you can combine the two elements together. Anyway, not to display anger or other emotions. And this thought popped into my head about emotion mind is the ability, sorry for the notification, just put that on mute, is the inability to restrain anger can have negative effects. So if you're always in that emotional, angry state of mind to where everything offends you, or you're in that state of mind where everybody is just out to get you, I thought that if somebody's like that, then people are less likely to interact with that individual. And I drew out this little diagram where angry interactions are at the top of this circle. And then I drew like a circle arrow down to social distancing from other people, right? People are less likely to interact with you if you're always angry, always yelling at them, and so they distance themselves from you, which would probably cause that person to be even more angry and just to treat everybody with this high level of suspicion and high level of animosity. And I think animosity is probably a good word for that. It's also stress inducing. I mean, when you're angry, I'm pretty sure your blood pressure just goes through the roof. And I think could also lead to confrontation with authority figures, right? Your job, or maybe with police officers, or I don't know, whoever. And my stepfather was this kind of individual. And I'm not sure it was totally his fault, because he had a really rough upbringing. I mean, I'm not trying to make excuses for the guy. And he was also bipolar. And you know what? When he was on his medication, things were really, really good. But when he got off of them, man, he was just... Like he would be happy and positive in one moment, and then in the next just would completely flip and just be this angry, suspicious, vile person. Him and I came to blows a few times because of the way that he would talk to my mom in one of his outbursts. And so I'm well aware of people that cannot contain their emotions. I'm well aware of what kind of person that is. I mean, I have a good example. So, and, you know, I just can't help but think that type of person that is always angry and thinking that the world is out to get them, you know, that it's just a self-feeding cycle until what's left or what is the end result for the person? You know, you become more of a beast than a civic man. And I think for Stoicism, that's the idea. That's the ideal person to be, is to be a human being of civility, to where you treat others with the utmost respect, but you also hold yourself to a higher standard. So, anyway, I kind of went off the rails on that one. And when you're in that state of mind, an emotion mind, the fight or flight instinct kicks in. I mean, it creates a constant state of chaos to where you're either confronting your problems with that high level of anger and animosity, or you're either running away from everything, so nothing gets resolved. And I think that could probably cause some shallow relationships to occur. You know, don't necessarily want to deal with getting hurt by a person, so it's the physical attraction that draws you in but doesn't really let you stay. I've had a couple of relationships like that. And we learn from this stuff. So the ability to regulate, to restrain your anger. I mean, there's a process for this. And I mean, I know in my own relationship, specifically with, you know, my wife, is to, you know, over the years I've developed a non-reactive practice, and it really helps me out in those difficult moments, because every relationship isn't perfect. So it allows me to take a step back, you know, when I feel that anger rising up over something, take a step back and identify, you know, what's going on in your body. When I get angry, I start feeling it. I start feeling it in my chest. It's like a burning sensation almost. And I think, you know, maybe I shouldn't say anything, because if I say something now in this moment, it's just going to make everything worse. And I don't want that to happen, because I love my wife and I love my kid, and I've experienced the anger from my stepfather yelling and cussing and just being a terrible person. And I don't want to be that kind of husband, and I don't want to be that kind of father. So identify, take a step back, take a breath, identify the bodily triggers, reflect on, you know, we as people have a tendency to build up our side of the argument as being the ultimate truth, whatever it is. And the other person is just completely wrong. But at some point, a shift needs to, you know, there's the thought, well, maybe she's upset for a reason. Maybe I should ask her why she's upset. So asking those questions requires you to engage, requires me to engage in a, with my wife in a calm kind of way, because once you start elevating your voice, they start elevating their voice, and then it gets into a shouting match, and then everything just falls apart. So I have to remember to use my calm voice. And I say things and I ask things in a respectful manner. You know, feel like maybe I made you upset. What was it that caused you to react in that way? Oh, well, you know, I apologize. I'm sorry. That wasn't my intention. You know, I feel like I'm, this is starting to get into a little bit of the self-helpy kind of stuff. I have this Bill Burr thing written down, because while I was working through this process of how I manage an argument, my mother inadvertently came up, and gosh, when I saw this clip, I thought, yeah, that's how me and my mom would argue for years and years and years. And yeah, I'll just play the clip and stop talking.
Never address how women argue, which I think is a core of a lot of that shit. You know, and I gotta tell you something, man, like, I never knew how women argued, but after 20 years of losing every significant battle in a relationship, I finally figured out how they argued. And I'm gonna tell you something, I'm starting to turn this franchise around. I have begun a winning tradition. This is how they argue, as far as I can tell, all right? If they're right, they argue the point. And they stay on point and make sure you stay on point until you're down on your knees apologizing, begging for forgiveness. All right? No problem with that. Totally respect it. But here's the thing. If they're wrong, they go rogue. They go off-road. They start thinking of shit you're sensitive about. Maybe you don't get along with your dad. And in their head, they just start concocting this evil statement. Totally designed. This desperate Hail Mary attempt to make you so fucking mad, you just call them a cunt. What it is, and cunt trumps all the bullshit they did to start the argument. Now it's not about that. Well, that's no reason to call me a cunt, and then that's it. You're in this room now, right? My girl knows my big thing is, my big fear in life is to be that dude who grows old, you know, grows old alone, has like that basement apartment, just screaming up at the younger couple, turn it down! That isn't music! So I noticed that anytime she was losing a fight, out of nowhere, she'd just be like, well, that's why you're just gonna grow old and be alone. Then I'd lose my shit. The next thing you know, I'm in the kitchen washing dishes for the 9th fucking time in a row. This is what the argument was about. I was so right. What happened? So if you learn anything from my ignorance tonight, just know this. Next time you're in a battle with your beautiful woman, your wife, girlfriend, whatever, and they start out of nowhere, okay? You're winning, and they just start saying that crazy shit out of nowhere. Just know in that moment you've won the fight, okay? All right? Don't get mad. Bob and weave, slip all of that shit. Maybe because you got a little dick. Just let that slide. Stay in the pocket of the argument. Okay? It's over. The argument is over. You've won. Just take a knee and run out the clock. All right? Yes. Lean on the ropes. Let them punch themselves out. And then in the end, you throw their psychology right back at them. Well, maybe we should discuss it later when you calm down. And they won't hook up with you for a couple of days. Who cares?
So, yeah. Man, I would get into some knockdown, just so many arguments with my mother. And it would always devolve into that kind of, like, she would bring up stuff from when I was a teenager, and then I would get mad, and then it would be about, the argument would turn into me getting mad at her, and then I'd be like, I don't get it. Like, I was right. I felt that I was right in this argument, and then I got mad, and then it turned into this, well, that's no reason to yell at me, right? And so eventually I learned to not react in that emotional state of mind. Don't react from the emotion mind, to, you know, realize that I'm feeling angry. Use my logical thinking mind to think my way through this argument, basically using wise mind through this argument. And eventually the arguments, I kind of understood that, oh, she doesn't actually have much to go off of once I calm myself down and like the argument just kind of would fall apart. So yeah, I just thought that was kind of interesting. So anyway, on to the second part of Marcus Aurelius's quote about his teacher, Sextus, to be free of passion and yet full of love. And I really had to sort of break this quote down. I had to look up the definitions of these words because, you know, it was like 2,000 years ago. So I'm pretty sure the words that they were using, or the definitions, probably changed over time, or how we use them have changed. And passion is defined as emotions distinguished from reason, an overmastering feeling. So being free of those overmastering feelings like anger, jealousy. Seems like his teacher was pretty level-headed. And yet full of love. And love, initially I thought about it from a relationship standpoint, and I was writing stuff down in regards to that, and then I thought, this seems a little out of place for a Roman era teacher, philosopher. So I thought, well, I had to go and look up several definitions of the word love. And one of them caught my attention. It was affection based on admiration, benevolence, or common interest. And I think the word benevolence stood out to me. You know, I've heard that word, but I've never really looked up. Sorry, if you hear my cat jangling around. And my wife just walked in with some catfish. And we are back. Jen just brought in these ginormous catfish. I have to be honest, guys. My wife is far superior of an angler than I am. And I'm happy to admit that. Anyway, getting back to passion versus love. So the definition of love that I found probably most applicable was the one that said affection based on admiration, benevolence, or common interest. And benevolence stood out to me because I've heard the word before, but I've never really delved into the definition of the word. And the definition is the disposition to do good. So, and I think that makes sense in him regarding his teacher in that way. Because for the Stoics, benevolence ties in with the Logos. And Logos, I mean, I know it appears in the Bible, if you are familiar with it. But in Greek and in Roman times, the Logos, the best definition that I could find about it was that reason is the controlling principle in the universe. So it's like, it could probably be equated to the intelligent design idea. So in Stoicism, if a philosopher adheres to the Logos, or the supreme intelligence, then their reason and actions are deemed as good, because the supreme intelligence, I would gather to assume that the supreme intelligence would be a force of good, because it would be more intelligent than human beings. I hope that makes sense. And I see a lot in Marcus Aurelius's writings, the idea of following along as nature intended. And when he uses nature, he capitalizes the first letter in nature. So a pretty important principle, and I think maybe next time we'll go further into that, because he writes a lot about nature, which I am a fan of. So I would consider that a very high remark about that teacher. And so I moved further along in the book. I believe I pulled this from book 3. And Marcus Aurelius says, well, actually, I wrote some of the quote down, but I should probably turn to the actual page in the text, because it does go on for quite some time. And the quote is, "You need to avoid certain things in your train of thought, everything random, everything irrelevant, and certainly everything self-important or malicious. You need to get used to winnowing your thoughts so that if someone says, 'What are you thinking about?' you can respond at once and truthfully that you are thinking this or thinking that. And it would be obvious at once from your answer that your thoughts were straightforward and considerate ones, the thoughts of an unselfish person, one unconcerned with pleasure and with sensual indulgence generally, with squabbling, with slander and envy, or anything else you'd be ashamed to be caught thinking." And this is a form of a different, well, perhaps it's related, but I consider this an internal form of self-restraint. And it reminded me of, and I'm pretty sure you guys have heard this in the media, on TV, different podcasts are popping up, different apps are popping up on the iPhone and Androids, is mindfulness. This is a part of cultivating a mindfulness practice, which is based on Buddhism. And however, it isn't just about meditation. There's a deeper level of the mindfulness practice. And this quote, I think, really catches the deeper aspect of mindfulness. And it has to deal, there's this thing in Buddhism called the Eightfold Path. And I had to pull it up because there's these different, let's see, sorry guys. There's these different, the Eightfold Path involves these different rules. So the first one is right view, second, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and then right concentration. So go down to right mindfulness. Mindfulness, it says on Wikipedia, mindfulness is interpreted as bare attention. Never be absent-minded. Being conscious of what one is doing. And I think that, So it's not getting involved, it's not ruminating on possible, you know, like possible futures, or like if you get into an argument, or maybe you're mad at somebody and you build up these fake arguments in your mind. I've done it before. Well, if they say this thing, I'm going to say that thing. And then it keeps going and going and going. And then your mind is just basically focused on this fake reality instead of concentrating on the moment at hand. And so to avoid getting daydreaming or ruminating on these possible hypothetical situations in your mind, I wrote down, develop mechanisms to bring me out of that state. So I, over the years, and there's this great movie called Peaceful Warrior. It's based off of this book called Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And at the end of the movie, this guy's teacher, I guess he hears him in his mind, and it's the where are you and when are you? And the guy answers, you know, when he says, where are you? I'm here. And when are you? Now. I think it's important to ask yourself those things. You're creating a checklist in your mind. I know it really helps me. I create a checklist in my mind. Where am I? I'm right here. I'm right here in this moment. And when am I? I'm now. I'm present. I'm supposed to be present anyway. And then take a breath, you know, in through the nose and out through the mouth. Been training my kids on these mindful breathing exercises, so it's pretty ingrained in me over the last think we've been doing it for about 6 months before the coronas shut us down. And then having that. So hopefully when you develop those mechanisms, because of course, inadvertently, we are human beings. We're not perfect. Our mind is going to start to drift. And when it does drift, you know, you create that checklist in your mind. You have your checklist. Where am I? When am I? So it's a form of mental self-restraint. Not indulging too much in, you know, unnecessary thoughts. I think is pretty important for the development of your mental state of mind. And I've been doing this for, or practicing these things for years now, and I'm not perfect at it, but I think just attempting and remembering, oh, this is, you know, you're straying a little bit, bringing myself back to the present moment, I think is really important. So I think, guys, that is going to be it. That's all I have written down from Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. The key points I thought, or the key quotes that really stood out to me regarding self-restraint. And I have to be honest, this took me about 4 hours of thinking and writing things through. And wouldn't you believe it? I only have three pages filled out. And that took me 3 to 4 hours to just get that. And I think we're about to hit the hour-long mark. So thank you guys so much for listening to me trying to develop my thoughts, trying to formulate my own personal philosophies. Thank you for listening to my journal exercise. I really appreciate it. If you liked this new episode, if you're on the iPhones, on the iTunes, the Apple Podcast app, please give it a 5-star review and leave a comment, and maybe say what you liked about the episode. This podcast is available on Google Podcasts and pretty much everywhere where a podcast can be found. It's also on Spotify. And please share it with your friends and your family members, possible coworkers, if you felt it was beneficial for you. Thank you very much. This has been Jason Harvey of the Cuddly Caveman Hour. See ya.